Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's myself, Patrick O'Shaughnessy at History Chappy. I had the pleasure of overhearing a wonderful interview that Elliot at the Librarian Six and Connell at Prohistoric Man had with a guest that we've not had on the show before. We were delighted to welcome a gentleman called Dr. Paul Goldsmith, who has specialist knowledge in the Chernobyl nuclear power plant disaster, which occurred in 1986 in the Soviet Union. Let's waste no time. Let's get straight to the interview. It's an absolute corker. So much great knowledge. I suggest you listen all the way to the end. It's Versus History. Thanks for listening.
The sound you just heard was the sound of radiation, counted by a Geiger counter. On the night of the 25th, going into the 26th of April, 1986, a chain of events began that would destroy thousands of lives, ruin millions of acres of land, and would, in many respects, help catalyze the reshaping of a world that had been in the grip of the Cold War since 1945. That event was the nuclear disaster that decimated Reactor 4 at Chernobyl nuclear power plant, near the town of Pripyat in northern Soviet Ukraine.
And to talk about the Chernobyl disaster, we are privileged at Versus History to be joined by Dr. Goldsmith. Dr. Paul Goldsmith, welcome to Versus History.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Elliot, do you want to maybe start us off with our first question?
Sure, I think let's get straight to it. What exactly is your connection to the event in Chernobyl in 1986?
Right, well, I was actually researching the effects of the Chernobyl accident. I did my PhD based on Chernobyl, and I was there in 2006-07, mainly in Belarus, which is just north of Ukraine, and actually 70% of the contamination from the accident fell on Belarus.
Oh,
and
dear.
I was,
wow.
I was there looking at the impacts and really trying to come up with a new method of monitoring the contamination, because whilst the accident was, as you said earlier, in 1986, coming up to the 33rd anniversary of that, the contamination, the effects are still being felt, and areas around Chernobyl won't be able to be, you know, lived in, used economically for a very long time. So my research and my investigation was really trying to find out a new way of monitoring that contamination and seeing if we could kind of map the contamination to work out, you know, where the hot spots of radiation are, really.
Okay, so before we get to the contamination, because that's very much obviously after the event.
Sure.
Connell, do you want to get into...
Yeah, I think it's probably good for our listeners to just have a bit... Why did this occur? So when we think of the Chernobyl disaster, we think of all of this radiation pouring out and contaminating, but how does that happen? How does it go from the nuclear power plant to this disaster?
Yeah, well, this is, I mean, nuclear power, of course, and especially after Chernobyl, it changed people's perceptions quite significantly about nuclear power. And really, it was a combination of factors that led to the accident. It was, one, a flawed reactor design. So the actual design of the nuclear reactor was flawed. And if people look back at those Soviet reactor designs, there's several things that are inherently flawed with the design of the reactor and how they were put together.
So is that in terms of how the radiation is contained, or
it's really concerned with the cooling of of the uranium, and that's part of the reason why the accident occurred. The second thing is this sort of Soviet sort of safety culture, hiding things, not necessarily opening up about issues, and people weren't trained properly. So it was a lack of training, a flawed reactor design, and then obviously just a chain of events, really, which led to the actual accident occurring. What a lot of people don't realise is that Chernobyl is obviously synonymous with nuclear accidents, but it was Reactor 4, one of four reactors, which you know, had the explosion, the nuclear disaster, if you like, and three of the reactors, three of the units, still continued to produce power, actually to up until the year 2000. So it was only one of the reactors. It was reactor 4 where the accident occurred.
Still actively producing power and being put into like the national
grid.
Yeah,
that's right. Mainly for Ukraine. But
how does that work? Because based on the research that I did for this, initially the exclusion zone was 10 kilometers, and then within a week it was expanded to 30 kilometers.
That's right, yeah.
And that exclusion zone has been in place ever since. So how is the electricity... How does it function?
That's a really good question. I mean, a lot of people also ask, you know, because Chernobyl now is a well-known tourist attraction. People go and visit there. Mm. And people ask, well, why? You know, how can you go there? The key thing is yes, it's the exclusion zone and the levels of contamination are beyond what you would want to be living in on a daily basis. But if you go for a day, a few hours, and you monitor the level of radiation that you're exposed to, then that's fine. You know, it's not fine, but it's, you know, it's okay, it's safe. The key thing is that exclusion zone is there because you couldn't live there, you couldn't grow crops there, you couldn't drink water there, you couldn't survive in that environment, you know, and be self-sufficient in that environment. So in terms of generating power, people are able to go in and out of Pripyat, the town where Chernobyl was, you know, to maintain it, to your personnel could go there and run the power plant, but you're right. Part of the issue is it's difficult to get information on exactly how that happened and who was there and who was producing power.
Right. I don't know whether you'd be able to enlighten me on this. The research I did for this was very confusing because not being a chemist or a physicist or any of these types of people, and I couldn't really understand the physics behind it. But essentially, there were two explosions, rapid fire explosions, which launched radioactivity into the air. What happened after that?
Right, that's a really good question. Yeah, nuclear material, excuse me, was released into the atmosphere, and the radioactivity that was released was really in the short term, immediately after the disaster, was iodine-131.
Right.
And that radionuclide, that radiation, if you like, is known to affect the thyroid gland, and many, many people were affected by that in countries like Belarus. But just going back a step, once that contamination was released, radioactivity is very, very mobile. The radionuclides that were released, they were sent up, because of the force of the explosion, and they were sent up into clouds.
Right.
And one thing that's really interesting, and what I was trying to do when I was in some of the areas that were contaminated by the accident, was find out whether there'd been cloud seeding, because what happened was this huge cloud of radiation pushed up into the atmosphere, and that cloud, that weather system, you know, containing all that radioactive material, was on the move northwards towards Moscow. At the time, obviously, capital of the Soviet Union, capital of Russia, and very heavily populated in comparison to countries like Belarus.
Right.
Belarus was just north of the reactor, The contamination was heading northwards, and what they decided to do, the Soviets were very much into weather manipulation, so they decided, right, all this cloud of radioactive material was caught up in the clouds, in the weather, moving towards Moscow, and they decided to try and seed the clouds using silver iodine, try and put these particles in the clouds to force rain over Belarus. So the idea sounds quite sensible.
It sounds to me like you're almost trying to get radiation to fall on Belarus before it reaches Moscow.
That's exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to force that contamination down over the areas of Belarus, which like you said, it sounds like a sensible idea in a way, because Belarus was far more agricultural, less populated, quite rural. The problem was they didn't actually warn anyone or evacuate those areas before cloud seeding. And when I was there, we found evidence. Wasn't just me. I was working with a team of scientists, and we found evidence that actually there had been cloud seeding. And while we were collecting this evidence and looking at what was happening, I had quite an exciting but also quite frightening experience in that we were told that we had to leave the country. We're in Belarus, of course, which is where 70% of the contamination fell. We had to leave.
When you say you had to leave, what do you mean? Can you tell us why you had to leave?
Basically, we'd been moving around the country, mainly around the areas, an area called Gomel, not close to the capital, but where the exclusion zone is. And we were in villages and areas and forests that had been contaminated.
And you had authorization to be there?
Well, we did have authorization. We had a visa to be there. But what the Belarusian authorities didn't like is the fact that we had a lot of contacts, a lot of local Belarusians that were helping us, and we were moving around. And what they didn't like is the fact that we were quite free in the country, moving around, looking at things, going into the forests and investigating it. And they didn't like that.
Right.
They also didn't like the fact that we found this evidence of cloud seeding. We were speaking to eyewitnesses.
So presumably that cloud seeding is something that's not been acknowledged by the
That's correct. It's not been acknowledged.
And then later the...
The subsequent governments haven't really acknowledged that cloud seeding took place. And we found evidence that it did. We started to talk about that. The people that we were with and the local Belarusians. And eventually the authorities kind of caught up with us. The paperwork trail caught up with us. And we were said, we were told, you know, you've got 24 hours to leave. Your visa is being revoked. Wow. You need to get out. And a professor I was with, he went one way off into... I went off into Lithuania. He went somewhere else. I think I can't remember now where he went. But anyway, we went separate ways. I went in a car across Belarus to the border with Lithuania. And of course, what was really interesting and a bit frightening is I had all my samples for the research I was doing. So I had to try and get them across the border. One of the things that the guards didn't like at the border is they were sniffing for ages is blue tack. They thought they didn't know what that was. But anyway,
wow.
But I managed to escape. But what was interesting is that the whole area when I was there, people living there, the Belarusians, you know, they were very, very friendly people, but still had this kind of culture of secrecy, a bit like you alluded to at the beginning of your piece when you said, you know, the Cold War, this idea of secrets and not being open and honest about what had gone on.
Yes.
And so, you know, it was fascinating, but a bit scary, but fascinating.
Well, in all honesty, I couldn't tell you what blue tech is.
No.
Can you? Could you?
Beyond blue sticky stuff that's
yeah,
reusable.
Yeah, I don't know what it's made of, but... yes.
Well, now, if we can just come back to this theme of secrecy... The disaster occurred on the night of the 25th to 26th. Pripyat was evacuated only after 36 hours.
Correct.
And they were told to leave their belongings because they were only going to be leaving for 3 days. And most of those belongings remain in Pripyat, exactly where they were left today. On the morning of the 28th of April, so that's 2 days after the disaster was known, alarms went off at Forsmark nuclear power plant, and that was in Sweden, which is 1,000 kilometers away. And initially, they thought it was their own nuclear reactor that somehow had leaked radiation. And when it became clear it wasn't from there, they then called, however you do this, the Soviet government and said, "Have you had an accident?" And initially they denied it as
it.
Well. And now I remember because I was of an age in 1986. I was 12 years old, and I remember that the big criticism, even at the time, just 3 or 4 days, maybe a week or 2 weeks after it, was that the Soviet Union simply had denied access to it, denied knowledge of it, because by its very nature, the communist state was enclosed, it was hermetic, they didn't like that information coming out. So was that your experience?
Yeah, that was definitely my experience, definitely. And you know, you're right. It was a long time before they would admit to the scale of the accident and what happened afterwards. I mean, we have to remember that contamination from Chernobyl covered much of the Northern Hemisphere. Now, obviously, not to the same level as immediately surrounding the power plant and in areas like Belarus and parts of Ukraine. But, you know, the whole of the Northern Hemisphere virtually had some levels of contamination. I know that in the UK there were restrictions in North Wales and certain areas on sheep and other products because of the levels of contamination. But you're right, the culture of secrecy was very much still alive when I was in Belarus and talking about the accident. People weren't always forthcoming. They were a bit reluctant, the eyewitnesses that had been around at the time, to sort of talk to us.
And, right.
You know, that's right. What was also, you know, really interesting is that the area I was in had been sort of earmarked for sort of economic development. There was the place I stayed while I was doing the research.
Is this
was
within the exclusion zone?
Close to the exclusion zone. It was a place where I could travel easily into the exclusion zone. And actually levels of contamination there were very patchy, but some areas were quite high. But I stayed in a sanatorium, basically a Soviet hospital, which had been designed and built and was supposed to be a really busy place in Belarus. There were shops that were, you know, that were going to be used and utilised. But when I was there, it was very much an area that, that was in decline. Most of the sanatorium wasn't used because there's no people in the area. They'd evacuated, they'd left. The shop that I used to go to daily to buy bread and things when I was working there, it was a big two-storey building. Just a tiny section of it was used, because what happened after the accident is villages were evacuated, people left, there were no jobs in the area. The primary sort of industry in that area would have been lumber, timber, and right. wood. And all that was decimated and couldn't ever build up after Chernobyl. So, it was a combination of secrecy and of an area that was, you know, was in some ways quite sad and in decline.
How close did you actually get to the site itself, to a reactor 4?
I didn't go too close to reactor 4, but I was in the exclusion zone. That's right. Primarily where I was working, in forests, working near to Pripyat, mostly in the forests of Belarus, and I was, you know, collecting samples from the soil, from vegetation.
You were searching for evidence of cloud seeding. What evidence would there be?
Well, that's a good question. Soil, chemicals in the soil. So there'll be a chemical signature in the soil.
Right.
Now, of course, it's quite difficult to detect that because...
Presumably that's because the rain would concentrate it.
Yes.
So it'd be more in the soil than if it was just... Yeah. Out in the atmosphere.
Yeah, you should. I mean, we found evidence in the soils. There was a paper that one of my colleagues wrote about. I was primarily interested in the monitoring of the contamination, but one of my colleagues that was there wrote a paper and published that about the cloud seeding. And there's definitely evidence in the soil of material that shows that the Soviets had seeded the clouds.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We hope that you are enjoying this episode of the Versus History podcast. Versus History are proud to have published a range of history books, all of which are available via Amazon. Our titles include the highly popular and best-selling 33 Ways to Improve Your History Essays, Blowing Up the Nazis, and University History Essays and How to Write Them, and many others. For more information, please visit our Amazon author page or versushistory.com.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that advert break, just surreptitiously thrown in there with no warning. So we've talked a lot and fascinatingly about kind of the spread of the contamination, how it's affected the different areas, people's lives, having to evacuate from their homes, etc. But one of the other areas perhaps that I'm interested in is kind of how it affected nuclear power plants and the kind of idea of nuclear power, because it's very much there's still that kind of niggling thing in the back of the head regarding nuclear power,
almost,
which presumably which does come a lot from Chernobyl. So how's that affected kind of the present and nuclear power?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's several things there. I mean, first of all, nuclear power was, you know, it's always been a contentious issue. But we have to remember that it does provide an opportunity to give us clean, reliable energy in terms of carbon dioxide and releasing emissions. It's very clean. It's not renewable because nuclear power uses uranium-235 primarily, which is a rare earth element. So that's not an infinite resource. So it isn't renewable, but it does provide us with plenty of clean energy. And many countries are still interested in pursuing nuclear power.
France has always been big on nuclear.
China as well. And this begs the question, of course, you know, should they be allowed to develop nuclear power when other countries have experimented with it, developed it, and then, you know, moved back from it? Public opinion usually is that nuclear power is not good, because people have seen things like Chernobyl, Three Mile Island. Yeah. Then, of course, recently, after the 2011 Japanese tsunami, you had the Fukushima nuclear power plant, which caused issues in terms of damaging sea life, and people in the area there had health issues from that.
Now, the Fukushima plant, there have only been two Category 7 nuclear disasters. The first one was Chernobyl, and then the other one was Fukushima.
Yeah.
I remember distinctly after Chernobyl that nuclear power became a very clearly political issue, and it really did go out of favor. And it is, it's only really, because you had the Three Mile Island.
Yes.
It's only really, I think, in the last 10 years that nuclear power has made something of a comeback. It's a political issue in England right now because the Chinese government is investing heavily in nuclear power in England.
In Sellafield, for example.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
So we have seen a return, perhaps, to the idea that nuclear power is perhaps a wise choice for energy.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, obviously, I understand both sides of it. I can see in terms of risk and what could happen, but also, like I've just said, it's one way to produce large amounts of relatively clean energy. And in terms of global warming and carbon emissions, if we're trying to reduce that, reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, then yeah, it is a really potentially excellent way to generate power. Interestingly enough, you said, politically, China, India as well, is interested in developing nuclear power. Now, I'm not sure about public opinion in those countries, and I know that they may not have the same level of political freedom, you know, in terms of the population as being able to protest and oppose nuclear power that we have. So that would be interesting to see whether they are able to pursue that, what kind of reactor designs they use. But I do know that both China and India are very interested in nuclear power.
Interesting for experts. The kind of reactor that they use, I'm sure, would go completely over my head. Great. So I guess what's next for Chernobyl then? So like the area, the power plant, you're saying these three reactors that were there were used for power until 2000, but presumably they're now not being used. So what... Is there a plan?
Well, correct. I mean, those nuclear power plants, those reactors, those units, like you say, were decommissioned, and the last one finished in about the year 2000. I would say Chernobyl is a process rather than an event. It's still unfolding. The areas around Chernobyl, some of the areas, there's different. You look at different papers and different opinions, and you see, well, when can people use that land again in the exclusion zone? Some people say 900 years. I've even seen a figure of 20,000 years before people can actually safely use that land and that area because of the sheer levels
for
of radioactive for agriculture and for, you know, to live there, to use it economically.
I was in some of my research, I was reading about kind of the wildlife, and that's obviously wildlife springs back because of a lack of awareness.
I can't understand how that's
possible. This is really interesting, in fact. But at the moment, tourism and, like you say, wildlife is thriving there. People are... there's two reasons for that. One is the fact that there's a lack of human population to disturb wildlife, i.e. insect populations are thriving, populations of mammals are thriving.
So there's sort of lynx and
there's all sorts of different animals there that are thriving. Partly it's, like I've said, the lack of human population. But one of the really interesting things I found, and is fairly well known in that kind of in those fields, is this idea that nuclear, we all think nuclear radiation, you know, radiation is bad, but actually every day we're exposed to radiation. There's been studies that show actually in the airline industry where they're exposed naturally to high levels of radiation, it has a benefit, you know,
right.
It doesn't, so it's not all bad. It's small to medium doses, there may actually be some benefits to radiation, and I think that's what we're seeing in the Chernobyl exclusion zone. We're seeing that actually radiation is causing some species to thrive, to be bigger, stronger than they might otherwise be. I know I did an experiment where I grew plants, and the plants that I grew with small to medium doses of radiation actually were healthier than the ones with no radiation. But then, of course, you get to a level of radiation that's too much, and you start to see that. It's called hormesis, this sort of J-curve response.
Can I, just before I get in, we get
sure,
into the
yeah,
conclusion
no, yes.
of it, do you get, surely you don't get animal life around, let's say, reactor 4?
No.
How far outside of that are we talking?
Well, the exclusion zone that was set up is 30 kilometres
so
radius,
yeah. Roughly, so it's outside of
that exclusion zone.
Well, I think...
I mean,
they
go anywhere.
Within the exclusion zone, you mentioned earlier about how there was kind of patchy... From my reading, I kind of saw a diagram of the levels of radiation that were being exposed, and it's not, as I imagine, I kind of imagined right in the centre, very strong, and then just
radiating,
radiating out in kind of very average... circles, but like you said, patchy, and so there are some areas relatively close to the reactor that have far lower radiation than others further
exactly.
away.
Exactly. So it's quite unpredictable in a way as well, where the radiation fell. Obviously, close to the reactor, it's highly radioactive. Mm. But yeah, as you go out, it is very patchy. When I was working there, I found areas that were very radioactive, and other areas that were within the exclusion zone that were not radioactive, which again is why I was trying to come up with a new monitoring technique, because of course it's so patchy that we need some kind of regular, easy way to monitor
and
the contamination.
Those patches move based on
radiation. I mean, the current radionuclide, that's the specific radioactive material that is dangerous, is cesium-137, and that has a half-life. Every 30.2 years, it halves its level of radiation. So we've only just gone through probably one half-life.
Right, right.
But it's highly mobile. It moves through the environment. So it's continuously moving through the soils, into trees. Believe it or not, there's a certain things that sort of accumulate radiation more than others, like mushrooms and berries. And it's to do with this idea that it's constantly moving through space and across time.
Now, let's draw this to a close, because this is versus history. And I'd like to just draw it back to perhaps the historical importance of the disaster. I have it's a rather large quotation, but it's from Ellen Boba Moyner, and I'd just like to read this out in terms of the consequences of the disaster, the political and historical consequences. She says the Soviet Union's demise followed quickly on the heels of the failed coup by communists in August of 1991. But many people believe that its roots can be traced to the public reaction to the Chernobyl accident and its aftermath, and to concern over environmental issues in general. In the words of Roman Solchenik, in short, for Ukrainians, Chernobyl became identified with the duplicity and failure, indeed the complete bankruptcy, of the Soviet system as a whole. It also served to mobilize large masses of people against that system. So I think there's a very clear correlation here between the disaster, the cover-up, the handling, the disenchantment of the Soviet people and the satellite states with the way that the Soviet government handled this disaster. The Associated Press in 2006 says that the government cover-up of the Chernobyl disaster was a catalyst for glasnost, which, to quote them, paved the way for reforms leading to the Soviet collapse.
So glasnost, the idea of openness.
Openness, which then led to reformed perestroika. Gorbachev himself, he said that the USSR spent 18 billion rubles, which at the time was $18 billion roughly, on containment and decontamination, which near bankrupted the USSR. In Belarus, the total cost over 30 years was $235 billion. And according to the Chernobyl Forum, 5-7% of government spending in Ukraine is still related to Chernobyl. So the financial and economic cost, not to mention the land that was taken out of cultivation,
exactly,
and what have you.
Yeah.
I've got 1,938,100 acres of agricultural land decimated, 1,715,000 acres of forest removed from production. This was not simply an environmental disaster. It was a political disaster that essentially restructured the world, because it helped to catalyze the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is an incredible link.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Yeah.
Okay, right.
Well, I guess it probably just remains to... Is there anything that you wanted to mention that we've not given you a chance, we've not asked you about?
I think it's been fairly comprehensive. We've gone through Chernobyl. I just would like to say again, going from what you've said, I totally agree with some of the quotes and the information you've said there about those political links, the economic impacts, and of course the fact that it really is a process. Even though this happened in 1986, a well-known historic event, this is a process. Things are still shaping events that are happening now, and it's a really great example of how the past affects the present and of course will affect the future.
Okay, well, I think that is a phenomenal run through of the disaster and its implications. That's all for us to say, I think, is thank you very much, Dr. Goldsmith.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank
indeed.
You very much.
Right.
And don't forget to follow Versus History on Twitter, on Instagram, and you could go to versushistory.com for our blog. Otherwise, it is goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.